This is the World Cafe, and our guest today is singer-songwriter John Mayer. We'll spend the whole hour with him. His new record, Born and Raised, was released this past Tuesday, May 22nd, and I had an opportunity to speak with him at the annual non-convention of public radio stations last weekend. I started off asking about his health. He's had throat problems that have led him to cancel his planned tour and even affected the recording of the new album. I asked him to tell us about it.
Had an operation in October of last year. And the operation is 50 minutes long. That's not the issue. The issue is in whether it takes or not in terms of the, what used to be a granuloma gets taken off in an operation and just becomes a flat wound, so to speak. And you just hope that that heals. And all that has to do is heal. I've learned all the terminology. Has to epithelialize over. And once you get that layer of epithelium over the wound, you're good to go. But to get that to happen is a little bit of luck, a lot of dedication and determination in terms of diet and restraining yourself from talking or singing and all that stuff. So it is quite a Herculean effort of discipline. And they also inject Botox into your vocal cords. Now, being a singer, they wanted to mitigate the amount of Botox that was injected so that it wasn't any sort of long-term nerve damage, which Botox is basically kills nerves. And so this time around, just got to get more. Just got to go for more this time. Everything has been staged in a way to prevent damage in the overall. So I would have been fine by now if I was doing anything other than singing for a living.
But you went and made an album.
Well, I made an album, half the record, three quarters of the record, I didn't have a problem with the vocals, and the other three or four songs I had to come back and sing. I had a good period of time, lucky enough to have a period of time in between the Botox wearing off and the granuloma coming back to where I could at least sing the record. So I was very psyched to have it done. I'd be a much different person state of mind-wise if the record wasn't out or wasn't coming out next week.
Yeah, I'll bet. But now you'll have to have the operation again.
Have to do it again, which means sort of doubling back on the entire discipline or the prognosis. And I'll do that. I just needed a minute because it takes a lot. You know, we're talking none of that. He says as he points to soda, nothing bubbly, alcoholic, chocolate, caffeine, anything pretty much. We're talking rice and chicken and water for 6 months, you know. So, and I've done it. I already did it. And I have to do it again. So before then, I'm just sort of trying to just expand again so that I can contract and have room to contract before I go crazy. And I also think that maybe as a writer, there is something to be gained from this period of time in that there's never going to be another period of time where I'm going to release a record and not go tour. So there's a certain sensitivity that I still have that I haven't had to trade in for repetition, let's say.
Yeah.
So I think you trade in sensitivity for repetition if you're touring all the time or if you're answering the same questions all the time. So because I don't have to do that because I can't, maybe it's very interesting to go into making a record at a clip the way they used to. You know, you'd make a record in March and you'd make a record in November. So this is maybe the only time in my life I get to do it.
You and Johnny Cash used to do that all the time.
Many people. And I don't think they had the same constraints on them in terms of where they had to be when, and they could stay writers. So I sit before you as a writer, not a performer.
Well, your talk a little bit about having to, you know, keep away from things and all that brings me to a point, which is also, I think, another point that led up to this album and the subject matter of this album and a lot of what's going on. Are you an addictive personality or are you a disciplined person? And can those two things coincide?
That's a great question. Addicted or disciplined? A little bit of both. Mm-hmm. I become, I would say disciplined. I don't stick with any one thing long enough for someone to recognize it as an addiction. But I'm an extremist, certainly, but in those extremes, I pick up things that I keep forever. So I'll go all the way to one side and be all about that for a minute, but I seem to collect it. It seems to accumulate. I would say that I'm more disciplined.
Mm-hmm. Is that new? Is that part
of it? No, I've never really had an addictive personality. I believe I'm disciplined to a degree, but if I realize there's something that if I hit a roadblock, I don't have any problem admitting to the people around me that we need to change the path. And I was just talking about that earlier today. Like, I think you can't be afraid of saying to someone, oh, and I tried for 2 weeks. I can't make the record here. You have to be able to say to people, like, and you didn't waste money or time. You just have to go somewhere else. So I'll try to write a record somewhere, record a record for 2 weeks. And if I'm not feeling it there, we pack up and go somewhere else. And you just have to go to where the path of least resistance is to the idea. So I guess I'm disciplined until I realize that maybe I need to be disciplined somewhere else.
When you talk about this, it sounds like, I mean, I know you worked with Don Was on this record, it sounds like the whole creative process, including the writing, takes place in these studios. Or did you? I know you moved to Montana. Did you? Was this like woodshedding? Did you go up there?
No, I actually went there very recently. It's funny, the press likes to make just huge, gigantic, salient labels for things. And I moved there back in November, so it's pretty recent. The record was done being written back in May, so... And I wrote it in New York. And my job, in a weird way, is to be sort of my own manager, where I can represent weird writer guy, what he needs to other people. So I can say, look, I need to be there. And I'm usually reporting on something legitimate. You know, I need to make sure that I'm taken seriously when I say to even my manager, like, I want to block out Electric Lady Studios for a year. But it didn't end up being a year, almost a year. Wow. Well, 6-8 months. But I mean, that's $2,000 a day.
Yeah.
So you have to be able to say, I know this is a panel about like how to not spend $2,000 a day, but let's take it up a notch and make it about how it doesn't matter as long as you're able to write something, and you got to go wherever you think you can write. And I wanted the same solace that like Hendrix built that place for, you know, and I got it. It was in that room. And the point of that is, and it doesn't matter if it's $20,000 a day, if you produce something at the end of it, it makes sense. You know, well, 20,000 is a little rough, but you understand what I'm saying.
I totally get it. And did you come in with any idea about what you were going to write about? Because there's a lot of things on this album. The first single, for instance, seems to be a call for, I wouldn't go so far as to say forgiveness, but, you know, understanding.
Yeah, I think the first order of business for that song is sort of like any songwriter. It's just reportage. And I guess if you report correctly on that situation, then maybe you get understanding, which leads to, like you said, forget. I think understanding. I think my enemy has been confusion. You know, I think confusion
ours
is
or
what's,
yours.
I've created confusion, which has become my enemy. I think I've made it difficult in the past for people to really just assess how they feel about me. You know, and I think I was so hell-bent on giving the directive for how to have someone feel about me that I became so over controlling and involved that it was like, I understand now the sort of sentiment of like, just back up like 5 feet from me. You know, there's so much, I feel like you're trying to make me feel something that I, number one, don't feel, number two, don't want to be made to feel just to make you, it was very selfish and over controlling. And so, for me, it was really great to go into a studio and write a record as a guy who now is going to try again. And by that, I mean only release a record and a tour, if I could tour, and just let that be. No more trying to insert a certain thought or a certain feeling about me into someone's head, like as if I could mastermind someone's opinion of me, which I think a lot of people try to do. I think there's so much branding that's taking place all the time. You know, I think it's one of the worst things that happened to me, and it's one of the worst things that happened to other artists, is that they become brand managers, and then they become PR managers, and then they become microscopic PR managers, and then it becomes about a tweet. And I'm not just jumping on Twitter. I'm just saying, then you start saying, oh, I've sent a tweet out that people are scratching their heads about. We've got to pull our head together and figure out another tweet that backs out of this tweet and makes people laugh and makes them forget they were upset about the last tweet. And while you're doing that, you become just completely enraptured in nonsense.
Well, you've got 3.5 million people following you. You did when you had that.
Yeah, and I consider that like 200,000 fans.
Yeah, yeah, okay, I believe that.
Yeah.
But I was going to say, people in this room could all raise their hand and say they've, that whole scenario, they've done all that.
Yeah.
They put out a tweet that they wanted to
take
back.
Even if it's to a smaller degree, you still put it out and people go, what? I don't know about that. Yeah. And you just become your own correction agent. Everything becomes about correction. And I just think this idea, and it's, I don't buy it, I don't believe it, that, you know, media is horizontal and you can be a singer and you can be just, you can be a brand, and now artists are their own brand managers. How good has that sounded? They're not very good on record. It doesn't end up with good record. I mean, I'm just talking about records. I'm not talking about like whether someone should be selling a perfume or not. That doesn't bother me. I just feel like the initial contract of making music sort of starts to break away when you become an agent of your own misinformation. I just think it's a waste of time. It doesn't mean anything in the end.
Well, what you've done musically has morphed a lot over the years, going from the first records to going out with the trio and then coming back with this. I have two questions here. Number one, I really want to find out what music you grew up with, because a lot of it is centered around the 70s and mm-hmm. a lot of music from when, before you were born. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of point to each. I mean, there's a Curtis Mayfield thing. This album, people have been referring, and you even do lyrically on it, to Neil Young and things like that. Was that what you initially listened to, that 70s stuff?
No.
Were you a normal guy?
You know, the answer to this, I think, probably divides people. Between people who believe it's cool to just hear something and want to do it too, and people who think there should be something more organic or grand behind that. Well, I'm a curious listener, and I get into things and I get way into them. And I didn't really pick up on Bob Dylan until 2010. I mean, there's a time in your life where Bob Dylan makes sense. It clicks. Just for a while, it doesn't for me. I know my friends, I just heard almost the parody. If you grow up hearing the parody of Bob Dylan before you hear Bob Dylan, you hear the parody, you know. So it was a long time where I just, not anything. But then one day you get through all the slickness in your life, and you go through all the stuff in your 20s, and you get kind of beat up and bruised, and all of a sudden you hear things that are beat up and bruised, and you kind of see a reflection of yourself in there. And so for me, I just didn't catch on for a certain period of time. Now, where I'm different, maybe, and maybe not as heroic as some people want it to be, I hear something and I go, I don't say I want to cover that. I say, I want to know what it feels like to pen something like that. And then if that's a cop out, then that's a cop out. But I say, I want to use those color palettes to say something I want to say, you know, cause I played the blues for a really long time. And I listened to that sort of extremely harmonically complex stuff like Sting and Steely Dan, and you can't, that stuff just doesn't keep giving the same amount every day. You do get to the end of it, especially if you're a musician. So all of a sudden, a sort of easier, not easier, but simpler approach to something is just how I felt. And I thought, well, I'm a musician. This is music I like. I'm going to get into this like I would get into books, or like I would get into a TV series. So maybe I'd want to make a show like Mad Men if I were a TV producer and I watched Mad Men for a while. You know, I mean, I don't know how else you can do it than that, is to see something and want to internalize it, you know. But, for, you know, when I was, to answer the question, when I was growing up, it was, you know, Genesis and Michael Jackson and Kool and the Gang and whatever was on MTV.
Age appropriate.
Yeah.
Indeed. I was wondering, could we play a little bit of the new song, Queen of California?
Because sure.
Because it illustrates some of these musical things, and it's a really, really great song. It's I guess it's the next single, if you're
keeping track. It is the adventurous next single.
Hello, beauty. Hello, strength.
I guess you make the influences kind of obvious in that one, because you say this.
Yeah, but it comes out that way. I mean, It's not a matter of sitting down with 3x5 index cards or something.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
You get in a room and you play. You pick up a guitar part. So it is organic in the sense that I listen to a lot of it and I get into it and I get excited about it. And I go in the studio. I don't say it's time to play one like that. But if the guitar starts doing this, well, now I get... It's almost like all these other things that don't go with that get grayed out, right? So now I've got only a few melodies that work with that guitar part, and then I've only a few words that work with that melody. And so it is a departure from the last record that I made and maybe the last three records that I made, but you could probably chart a similar departure in all other areas of my life. You know, maybe you go to a new building if the other one burnt down. You know, maybe it's...
there you go. Yeah, I like that. Well, so there you are, and you got a couple ideas. You got a couple. There's a couple of really distinct guitar riffs in there that go with it, and you've got a vocal idea. What's Don Was doing? Is he sitting in the middle of the studio stroking his beard, or what's he
doing? He's there. We had a red couch that sort of by the end of it just became his couch, like. Anytime I see that couch in that studio, that's just Don's couch. And he has Don travels with his only equipment in the studio, and this is just the coolest thing ever, is a pair of headphones and a different amp for his laptop that he can plug into that sounds better than the one that's supplied in the laptop. And that's all he brings with him. And he brings those headphones because he's very used to the way they sound as reference. And he just sits and you play the track over and over again. You just keep trying and trying and trying it. And he'll talk to you back to the microphone. And he's just staying macro. So, and he's just always thinking about, he's almost like the... every time we play a take, he's in the music store putting it on, listening to it. Right. So he's just at the end of the assembly line. He has the ability to go to the end of the assembly line and just always keep an overview of whether it's on track or not. You know, so is a great motivator and also a confidence keeper if you want to try something for an hour, that you don't feel like the whole session hinges on whether you've made the right decision to chase something down for an hour. He's got your back. He's outside the cave holding onto the rope, you know. It's just a taste of some of the metaphors you'll get this afternoon. The only way I can explain myself.
John Mayer from the Non-Convention in Philadelphia this past weekend. We're spending the entire hour with John today. More in a moment on The World Cafe. I'm David Dye. This is The World Cafe. More from my conversation with singer-songwriter John Mayer from this past weekend. He released his new album, Born and Raised, this past Tuesday. I want to talk a little bit about your parents because they're in some songs you're on here as well. Mm-hmm. They split in this period of time, or
yeah.
How was that for you?
I feel like it's important that that doesn't ever enter the airspace around me. Like I don't really want to get into it. Except I will say that there does come a point where you stop being. You become your own person. You don't have parents above you, you know. So I found myself really realizing that, oh, okay, so these are now the first years of the rest of my life in that I've got to create a family. I don't really belong to a family as much as I now am the seed for another family. So you start seeing things as prospective rather than retrospective. You know what I mean? So instead of the reminiscing, the sad reminiscing, you have your little mourning period, and then there's different types of mourning your parents, and one of them is that they're no longer your parents together, which is, you know, but they do not have each other, which is the lyric in that song. And you move from the sort of sadness of like, you know, Stop This Train is sort of the sad, which was on a continuum a couple records ago, that's about the sadness of what won't be. Mm-hmm. And Born and Raised is sort of like just switching tracks to the excitement of what you can create as an adult. You know, like this is my first adult record. Everything else is me kind of like looking up in the bigger world and going, wow, or how do I do this? And Born and Raised is me saying, I think I got that. Now I figure out at least where my direction is that I have to go in. You know, you got to build your own home. You can't keep trying to find, you can't find home on a map anymore. You have to build it yourself. And that's the transition period.
How did that take place though? I mean, is in this period of time, how did you make that transition? I mean, some of us grow up, some of us don't,
yeah.
But you know,
you just have to go through it. You have to go through it. Sometimes you're on the phone or you're in front of your therapist and he looks at you and goes, yeah, that's messed up. You have to learn that not everything has a solution that day.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's part of the thing about growing up is that certain things are not going to be figured out today, and that you may have to go to sleep with two or three knots in your head, and there's nothing wrong with that, and they will get figured out. You know, those are deep questions. I mean, I'm still figuring that out, but...
But you had the confidence to call this thing Born and Raised.
Yeah. So. Yeah, the idea that you haven't been born and raised yet was very interesting to me. That basically it's not over yet. It's really a record about not being discouraged about the future, you know, about or your past.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it was me. I pick up pretty quickly, even if I need to get hit in the face with an anvil to figure it out. As soon as I get hit in the face with the anvil, I'm like, got it, got it. In this case, it would have been nice to have only felt 5 seconds of the anvil, but I mean, it was a lot longer than that. And I think that's cool that it was, because that would have just been me still trying to control. Like, let me tell you how long I need to be grounded for. And you can't do that.
Yeah.
You can't be like, I'm thinking you should ground me for a week because I'm going to learn my lesson.
But you grounded yourself. You pulled back from all.
Yeah, I just went back. I mean.
You knew enough to do that. That's pretty mature.
And where I didn't, people just really told me at that point. I was ready to admit that I don't know everything. You know, I think if I could have gone back in time, like a slightly older, longer haired, hat wearing me could have gone back in time and said, admit to yourself you don't know what you're doing. And I just climbed back in the portal and disappeared. I think it would have been different. You know, but you're still on the same push out to sea that you start on your first record, you know, and it's not my business to like name other artists who do that, but you see other artists who correct it's a crash, and you have an opportunity to keep that a crash and go crazy over it and just devolve further into darkness, or you can see it as a correction and then begin again from the correction. And for me, it was a crash that thankfully I turned into a correction. And you see it happen, you know. You see people, you can see them kind of heading towards the wall because they say they got this. And they did have it, but that was when the game was different or smaller. You know what I mean? It's like you can get out of certain things when you're younger, when you have two records out. There's, you know, we all start out taking pride in the fact that we run our careers. We take pride in the fact that we figure out a way to get a gig. We figure out a way to get a website, figure out a way to get a Twitter, figure out a way to get to 100,000, figure out a way to get to 500,000. By this point, you're a master manipulator is all you are at that point. And then you get to a point where people start saying, then you start doing interviews and stuff. And for me, I was so paranoid. I was completely paranoid that I think what it came down to was that I saw everybody with a microcassette recorder on a dinner table as someone who was trying to get me. What I eventually did, because I got, it was so telltale heart. I mean, I went, well, if that's the knife you're going to stab me with, I'm going to stab myself with it first so at least you didn't do it. And that's deep. That's a deep level of control freakiness, that I'm going to commit suicide so you can't say you murdered me. Even if they weren't even trying to do that, they would have just heard your story, whatever it was. But I didn't want to tell my story because I wasn't even sure what it was. Most of my brain was partitioned into BS management, where I wish I would have known whatever it took to know to be like, none of that stuff matters. But I, every dog in the race, every single dog that didn't matter in the race, except for the one that actually won races, which was like writing songs and putting out records and being thoughtful that way. But
so you don't think it necessarily had to do with a feeling of power you got from having so much success so early?
No. Well, no, not power, but I think there was an unreasonable expectation that this just happens. Mm-hmm. You know, and what I did in that time off was like kind of go back and reassess everything that had been bestowed upon me. I didn't make that happen. That was given to me. I do think there is something. I don't know that it's power. This is not the word I use for it. But I did.
Self-confidence, I guess, is another
sure,
way of
putting it. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Ultimate autonomy.
Yeah.
To the point of like, but never used for evil, really, up until the point where you just lose yourself and you believe that your ability to articulate ideas, no matter what the ideas are, will get you through. And that is the fulcrum point of losing yourself, is where you feel, and it happens in relationships, it happens with people. And I can stop someone on a dime and I go like, you're the smartest person you know, aren't you? And they go, huh? And I go, you have the ability to articulate any idea, right or wrong, to yourself and others, don't you? And they go, huh? And you go, I know, I was like that. Like, good luck with it and call me if you need me, because I know how that pans out. These are people who do wrong and say, what? What? How did I hurt you? When they start having conversations, like debates about whether you were hurt or not. What? How could I have hurt you? Tell me how I hurt you. And then they tell me, impossible. Here's the 9 reasons I couldn't have hurt you. Blah, 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 blah. And then you realize, oh, I'm a punk. This is how punks are born, you know?
Well, you know, I was thinking of when you were talking about that, something that it begins with is you're able to write songs that people, I mean, you wrote a couple, Bodies in Wonderland is an ultimate kind of love song. Daughter is, you know, fathers are playing that for daughters everywhere. You've got Love is a Verb on this, which I am sure that a lot of guys are going to play for their girlfriends or vice versa.
Yeah.
And that is a really powerful thing to be able to get across to people like that. That is a gift. So I can see how you would assume that whatever you're going to say or do is going to be.
Yeah, but that's still, I want to make sure that I'm getting, that I go down for the right crime, so to speak.
Yeah.
It was never that conscious. Never once. I mean, I was always in a very passive stance in terms of like, I was always kind to people around me. I was never, I mean, I was still at that point, never had a problem absorbing the energy of being broken. Mm-hmm. I would never put it on other people. I was never moody. I think the tendency is to believe that the more successful you get, just the more sort of, I know, I didn't. People probably saw me sort of breaking down slowly, but it wasn't a matter of breaking down by way of point. No, friends didn't defect. It wasn't like that. It wasn't like someone saying like, you've turned into an ass, I'm out of here. It was more or less just inverted on itself. And it was, you know, it wasn't, I didn't mistreat anybody, I don't think. But I think there was this like notion, I think, in people that was like, I love that guy, but I don't want to be anywhere near him when that goes off. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to be anywhere around that guy. I also did the thing that control freaks do where they want to change the narrative about them, even if the narrative is superlative. Even if you're being lauded for something, you're such a control freak that you go, no, those aren't the words I want you to use. I don't like earnest and sensitive and singer-songwriter. I want to replace them with this word and that word and that word and that word. And that's where you get in trouble, is choosing your own destiny on top of a destiny that's already beautiful. And now I want those words back. As I get older, I want to be those words. Like, there comes an age where, you know, you go like, well, the Jack Johnson and Jason Mraz and Coldplay and you know, these are who I'm going to be remembered with. That's great. Stop being a freak about wanting to be, no. It's going to be this person and that person and that person and that person. And I see it happen in other artists all the time. And I just think everybody would be a lot better off if they just shut their eyes and sang and then left and didn't think about it again.
Did you know that you could be wrong and swear you're right? Some people been known to do it all their lives. But you find yourself alone just like you found yourself before. Like I found myself in pieces on the hotel floor. Hard times help me see I'm a good man with a good heart. Had a tough time, got a rough start, but I finally learned to let it go.
Shadow Days, that is the first single from the new John Mayer album, Born and Raised. We'll hear more of my conversation with John when we get right back to the World Cafe. This is The World Cafe. I'm David Dye. More coming up from my conversation with John Mayer, who just released his new album, Born and Raised. This is the title track.
Then all at once it gets hard to take, it gets hard to fake what I won't be. Cause one of these days I'll be born and raised, and it's such a way.
We're talking with John Mayer about his new album, Born and Raised. And it's so funny, all the stuff we're talking about you spent all this time putting in songs like that in just a few lines. It's really hard to get all these, sculpt all these emotions into those lines. That's your talent.
Hard compositionally?
Yeah.
I mean, it's as hard as it's ever been to write a song.
Uh-huh.
But I think the benefit, or I guess the protective layer of being able to write these without feeling vulnerable, is that I just forget the record's ever going to get released. I think when you're working on a record, you're in this really safe environment where you're really just writing the music for the music. And then when the band comes in, you're just trying to look at each other and smile and high five and feel like you get the song. So I think forgetting that I'd ever be here talking about the record is a good thing is a good space to make the record in.
So you don't necessarily expect people to be sitting there listening to them over and over in their headphones and feeling each, you know, trying to analyze you at each.
That's okay. I mean, people have been doing that for 100 years.
Yeah.
You know, but that's the best way to get to know me. I mean, I think we live in a time now where people are trying to decode things, and I think that's ridiculous. You know, although maybe they always did, and I'm just picking up the wrong part of history, but I feel like there's so much doing anything other than listening to it. Like, as if abstract thinking is just completely dead.
Right.
The idea that you could just listen to an abstract idea instead of saying, well, what's that for? What's that about? Who's that to? It's like, I write emails to people. I don't write songs to people. Or I'll call people on the phone if I have a question, or if I want to, you know, I'll write a farewell letter. I'm not going to write a song,
right.
You know, because if I wrote it in a song, there's a chance that person wouldn't understand it was for them. Right? So
they may not spend the time interpreting this.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a pretty explicit guy, so I would much rather write the farewell letter, and it's easier that way, and it doesn't have to rhyme.
So when you got in the studio, did you have rules? Was there
Yeah, good question. Yeah. Rule was write songs, just write them, and don't worry if they're good or bad while you write them. Write bad ones.
Mm-hmm.
If I was going to have a songwriting class, the first day would be 15 minutes long, and I'd say, here's your first assignment. You can all leave. Write me a song as bad as you can make it. And you would see a lot of people not coming in that next class because they'd be too afraid to make the bad song. You've got to start from zero. Even me going into writing another record now, got to write bad ones. It's so funny. You could stop for 6 months, and you start at the beginning again. Mm-hmm. Like, whatever happens during mixing and mastering just steals your writing ability away or something. Certainly touring for me, but... So the rule was write bad songs, but write them. If you start writing bad songs, you start writing better songs, and then you start getting really good. If you try to get in the building on the 12th floor, you'll never make it. You have to get in the basement floor and work up from there. So, you know, the Whiskey is like the fifth or sixth song I wrote before it was the first one for that record.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's where it's got to... That was one of the rules. The other rule is no drum machines, no fooling the ear. You know, I mean, the thing that people don't understand, or maybe actually this is a room of industry people you probably do understand, is that artists are such performance-based people that even the engineer is someone that we worry about wasting their time if we're not doing a good enough song, if we're not playing a good enough take, you know. So because I write in the studio, there's a couple other people there. So sometimes I feel like I'm bringing them with me on my back.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to look for a song or something, and I'm bringing them with me, and they're thinking, why are we here? This guy's not going to... I mean, I put their voice in their head, into my head, like they're saying, why did I get stuck with this session? This guy's got nothing. But they're not saying that, but that's what I say. And so what I used to do is like, give me a loop. And then you get... And you think, see, they're glad they're here. This is how... But nothing. It portends to be something, but it's nothing. So then you go, and I've done this. I've wasted countless hours. Then you go, you go, give me a bass. Loop that. You sit there like, give me a guitar. And you sit there like this, and you go like, let's get lunch. Because all you're doing is creating a jump rope with just like barbed wire on it. It's just like, so I'll say to people, so what I did on this record, like a lot of these songs I say to like the engineer, like, hey, can you turn me down in the control room? And he's like, yeah, text me when you're ready. So he'll turn me down, and I'll be going basically the world's most expensive headphone amp, because I'll be going from tube mic to, like, Neve board to, like, compressors to a plate all the way back to just my headphones so that I can hear myself when what sounds like a finished product.
Right.
And then I'll grab some. I'll go for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours until I get, I'm a good man with a good heart. Oh, D over F sharp to G with those notes. And I'm a good man with a good heart. Oh, yeah. And then I go, turn me up. And I go, check this out. And then that's sort of what we work on that day. I go, check this out. And then I feel like emotionally I've made it worth their while. I feel like I've bought their trust in a weird way. People pleaser to them. That was, you know.
Wow, there you are in your $2,000 or whatever studio playing to yourself. I mean, it's a really odd.
Yeah,
it's a really odd.
But I have to be. But it takes me back to where I started out in an apartment building alone, where I could sing alone. I have to be able to just be so free, and go. Moonlight is bouncing off the river. The time is just what I won't do as a writer is hum. That was the other rule. Humming doesn't write songs. I won't co-write with people because I don't tolerate humming. And by the way, anybody who doesn't hum in a co-writing session doesn't need to co-write because they're so maniacal they'll do it themselves. People who co-write need writers. I mean, I don't see two autonomous, self-sufficient writers getting together to write with each other. Co-writing is a matter of trying to ask for someone else's ballast or something to what you don't have. And so my rule is I never hum. Humming achieves nothing. So I bought a typewriter for like $100, and I would just type 3 or 4 pages a night so that I never went in the studio and didn't sing something. And a lot of those lyrics stuck.
You've done very few kind of publicity things for this, but one of the things you did do was go back to Berklee School of Music, and talk with people there.
Yeah, but that's not linked to any record. I just do that when I have some time.
But what was that like? What was your? Did you have a message to them?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I get nervy and think I know a lot about everything, but I only know a lot about a few things. And that's, I think that's okay to say. I know a lot about a few things, and I think those things I want to tell people, especially if they're in college and they're, you know, 19 years old. And I think if they hear it from someone who they consider to be somewhere they want to get to, that there are certain things that they don't need to be thinking about, I think that's a good message to give somebody. It's like, I know you've got a ton of passion to spare here. Here's where you don't have to worry about it. Don't think about a record deal. It's ridiculous. Don't think about it. I mean, the entire culture is wrapped around a record deal as something to aspire to. And I mean, I'm really glad I have one, certainly. But on the way to getting one for me, I had to be told, I had to have my dream replaced by smarter people than me. They had to supplant the dream of getting the oversized $500,000 check with, I'm going to fight for an equipment budget for you. And if you don't kick and scream for that, you're probably going to be all right, because it means you're priorities are straightened out. Mm-hmm. I just thought, like, well, I get paid now, don't I? And it's like, no, you already owe us. You owe us $50. Signing fee. Yeah. You know.
It's funny. Today we're at this conference, and Norah Jones played later, and you're here now. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about when your careers started.
Yeah.
Was a time when there was a music business, and you could actually put out a record and sell records and, you know, buy a house or whatever.
It was the last 5 minutes of that. We got in under the wire, didn't we? And I remember Nora's record was in your office. And you had my record that was stamped on a CDR and hers that was stamped on a CDR.
Right.
Well, I think you could say probably even... I think there's a little bit of revisionist history. Because I think in 2001, you could have and probably still did say the same thing then, that the record industry was over. That CDRs or Napster was coming in. We were going to be done.
Right.
You have a choice in these moments of panic... or hold your breath and slow your heart rate a little bit and think. And panic never got anybody anywhere. I think those 10 years that record companies could have really started engaging, they just panicked. And I think a lot of what we lost was during the time they panicked. And then right when the ship kind of righted itself, we were left with sort of like kind of plug the hole a little bit. I mean, I don't know anybody who illegally downloads anything anymore. I don't know. I just don't know anybody who illegally... I don't know where you to go to illegally download. It's just easier to pay the 99 cents and get it and not depend on some dude at Villanova who not turning off his computer before you're done getting it. Like, I just feel like they've made it so easy. And it was really nice to be a part of something with Nora. And I remember it was like No Such Thing, and it was Don't Know Why, and it was like trouble by Coldplay, and it was, you know, Jack Johnson, and I think I was just too maniacal to enjoy being a part of that tapestry. But I don't know what part of that's different now, except for really the talent level of people. Mm. I mean, I'm always going to be I'm a meritocracy guy. I'm just a meritocracy guy. So I feel like if Norah Jones came out with that record, or another Norah Jones came out with that record, what would stop it from working today? It's just a matter of everyone's eyes being on a different thing. You know, I mean, thank God for it. I mean, how am I going to say this without being, I just want to be 100% complimentary of her. She's the real deal. But there used to be 6 real deals, 8 real deals, 10 real deals, you know. I mean, how is it that the bizarro novelty story is that a singer who didn't win a competition is selling 6 million records? How is that the bizarro story, you know? And again, I hope that takes nothing away from her, because I think she's just so good. I think she would have sold, I mean, imagine how many records she would have sold in 1996. It would have been on every coffee table in the world, you know?
Back in the day when you were starting out, was it like, to use a sports analogy, were you worried about everybody's ranking on the tennis scale?
Yeah, but I first of all, I love Norah. When Room for Squares first came out, it was a dogfight for like, I don't know, number 4 or 5 on the chart every week or something.
Right.
She would like, most weeks she'd beat me, and some weeks I'd beat her. I'd be like, where's Norah? 32, where's you? 30. Damn. But never was it vitriol at all.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
John Mayer, thank you very much for hanging out.
Thank you. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
Yeah, seriously.
Thank you.
When do you have to go, stop drinking soda and stuff and go back and get this all done?
I am going to stay inside this unique situation for a minute and look around. As long as my plane isn't working, I might as well just spend a couple nights sightseeing. So that's another metaphor, man. I told you, they're going to be great. I'm just going to hang out in this mode for a minute. I'm not very comfortable. I'm glad that I'm not comfortable with press anymore. I think it means that the right mechanisms are working and the wrong ones are shut down.
Right.
And make a record in July and August.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's great.
And if I can sing a little bit.
Yeah.
The problem is that singing makes me not able to sing. So maybe I'll just do like a different voice. I mean, I don't know, but I've got to write. I want to write and record and make another record. And maybe it's just this thing. I'll do it, JJ Cale. And I can do that all day if I got to, because I don't really need to use my voice that much down here. Oh, down here. Like, I'll make that.
Just don't hum.
Just no humming.
Yeah.
All right, Daddy Callback.
John Mayer.
Thank you very much.